mornings, I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today, University of Findlay President Dr. Catherine Fell shares an update on the pending merger between UF and Bluffton University. Also this morning, with Congress back in session, Representative Bob Latta discusses the series of measures on the agenda this week targeting emerging threats from China. Flag City Honor Flight chartering another group of veterans to Washington, D.C. today. We'll get a live update from the hangar at Toledo Express Airport ahead of takeoff. And September is National Service Dog Month. A new partnership aims to provide these highly trained canines to every person who needs them. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Tuesday, September 10th, 2024. Among the first things you need to know this morning, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day, kind of sad. Yesterday, the memorial service was held for Johnny Gaudreau, the Blue Jackets hockey player that was killed by a suspected drunk driver while riding a bicycle near the family home in New Jersey back late last month. He and his brother Matthew were laid to rest in Pennsylvania. The memorial service was held yesterday, and Meredith Gaudreau, the widow of Johnny Gaudreau, says that she is pregnant with their third child. During her tear-filled statement at the service, she made the announcement she hadn't publicly said that before. It is just, man. Matthew's widow, Madeline, also pregnant with their first child. And that is just heartbreaking. Just absolutely heartbreaking. And certainly thoughts and prayers with the family. I was just stunned. Saw that story. Let's see. What else is going on in the world? Another Ohio-related story here. Sales of recreational marijuana seem to be going strong across the Buckeye State. The Ohio Division of Cannabis Control reporting that nearly $55 million in non-medical sales were made during the first month of legal licensed adult use in the state of Ohio. $55 million in recreational marijuana sales. That includes nearly 6,200 pounds of cannabis flower and more than 840,000 manufactured products like edibles and vapes and drinks and things of that nature. Over 120 Ohio dispensaries have been making recreational and medical marijuana sales since early August. So 120 Ohio dispensaries, none in Hancock County, as we know. But that is an amazing amount of money in just 1 month, $55 million in 1 month. Now, how long that remains, the sales remain that strong, remains to be seen. We'll see. First month, something new, all of that. I'm imagining that that is an inflated number that will come back down to earth and level off eventually. But that is still an amazing start to recreational marijuana sales in the state of Ohio. Question is, what do we do with all of that money? That is still yet for the legislature to decide. Let's see here. Elsewhere, among the first things you need to know this morning, you know that the weather is going to heat up. We've had some cool days, but yesterday was a little bit warmer than it was over the weekend. Going to continue to warm up, a little bit warmer still today, and then tomorrow and Thursday, you're going to be back up near 90 degrees once again. It is the summer that just won't end. Mother Nature just won't loosen her grip on the summer weather here, even though we are into meteorological fall. Technically, the calendar hasn't turned over yet. The autumnal equinox is still, about a week and a half away, but a couple of weeks away. But if you think it has been hot here this summer, I'm a couple of statistics, and I'm not sure which one is more impressive here. Death Valley in California has recorded its hottest summer ever. Now, Death Valley is known as the hottest place on Earth. Back in 1913, it set the all-time worldwide temperature record of 134 degrees. 134 degrees. Death Valley National Park set another record this summer. The daily average temperature between June and August was 104.5 degrees, beating their previous record by 0.3 of a degree. From June 1st to August 31st, there were only 9 days when the temperature dipped below the triple digits. 9 days all summer below 100 at Death Valley. So that is very warm. But what may be even a more impressive statistic regarding the heat this summer in Phoenix, which is certainly a city accustomed to heat, intense heat. It has been an exceptional summer as well. 1 week ago, this past Tuesday, the city reached a milestone marking its 100th straight day of temperatures at least 100 degrees. 100 straight days of 100 degree plus temperatures. That is wow. And that was a week ago. At the time, I haven't been following this or tracking this. So in the ensuing week, I don't know whether they have continued that streak. But at the time, meteorologists said there was no end in sight. So I'm assuming that the heat has continued in the city of Phoenix. That is so. I just bring that up because if you're looking at the extended forecast and you're thinking, you know, I think I'm ready for fall. I think I'm ready for cooler temperatures. I've had enough of the heat. Just consider the fact that it could be a lot worse. We've had a very hot summer, but it ain't been that hot. So let's not complain too much. So this is something that maybe you can relate to as you are just starting your day. If your day is already off to a bad start, chances are, well, let's put it this way. I'm going to read this a different way on this story here. If you're worried that it's going to be a bad day, chances are good you will know by 8:36 a.m. That is the time when most Americans, according to a new survey, that is the time when most Americans know that it is going to be a bad day. That's the delineating mark, 8:36 a.m. If you can make it to that point, you've got a pretty good shot of avoiding a bad day. But if you can't even make it to 8:36, then, well, it's a lot, you know, all hope is lost. So they asked, what constitutes a bad day? They asked when it starts and what constitutes a bad day. 36% of people say that they come to terms with feeling sick upon waking up, or that a poor night's sleep has caught up with them by 8:36. 31% said a poor night's sleep catches up with them at 8:36 a.m. 29% says by then they have already had or are in the middle of a headache. So that's the other big warning sign. And if people manage to get past those maladies, those conditions, 26% say 8:36 is about the time that they have misplaced their keys as they're trying to get out the door to start your day. Misplacing your keys. Even worse, it is by that time when they have discovered that they have forgotten their phone after already leaving the house. That is a bummer. I've done that. And that is, you know, it's going to be a bad day when you discover on your way into work after you've already left the house that you have forgotten your phone. 25% say that is a surefire sign it's going to be a bad day. And especially you discover this when you've gone too far to really turn back. I mean, if you're just at the end of the street, if you're just out of your driveway, then that's one thing. If you're not out of your neighborhood yet, you can always turn around and, you know, and get it. But if you're halfway to work or more and you realize that you have forgotten your phone, it's really too late to turn around and go back. 26% reported that if any of those things goes bad that early, then they consider the day ruined. Those are the top responses. The survey revealed that the average person suffers 4 bad days a month, or about a month and a half's worth of bad days a year. So I guess the only upside that you can take away from this is that if you have one of those days, you are certainly in good company. Because the average person has 4 of those days a month. Not coincidentally, there are 4 Mondays in most months. I'm just saying. Maybe this will make you feel better, or maybe not. Wallet Hub is out there with their annual report on the happiest states in America. And if you want to avoid those bad days, you want to get away from those bad days, pack up and move to Hawaii. That is the top spot in the happiest states in America survey. They examine 30 key metrics, including emotional, physical, economic, and social well-being. Hawaii's natural beauty and laid-back lifestyle contribute significantly to the happiness of its residents. And if you've ever been to Hawaii, they are very laid-back in Hawaii. It's a very laid-back vibe. In Hawaii, you could see where it would be the happiest state in America. Interestingly, Maryland is right up there with Hawaii at the top of the list. So I'm not sure why Maryland, but believe it or not, New Jersey is 3rd on the list, followed by Utah and Delaware, rounding out the top 5. So I would not have guessed New Jersey. Hawaii, I can see that. New Jersey, was a bit surprised, was in the top 5. As for the unhappiest states, well, those would be Louisiana, Arkansas, and West Virginia at the very bottom. But here's the kicker. Ohio is only 40th on the list. 40. Number 40 out of 50 states. So, if you are, again, if you're having one of those bad days, not much of a surprise if you live in the Buckeye State, because apparently we have more than our fair share. Number 40 on the list of happiest states of America. I would not have guessed that, but there you go. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Tuesday morning started here.
WFIN News, I'm Matt Demchek. Your WTOL 11 weather. Plenty of sunshine expected again today with a high in the low 80s. Mostly clear tonight, low in the mid 50s. The Seneca County Sheriff's Office says a car reported stolen from a Wall Street residence in Tiffin was found on fire in the 5,000 block of North State Route 53 in Tiffin. The fire was put out and was determined that the vehicle was possibly deliberately set on fire. Upon further investigation, authorities identified a man from Fremont who reportedly had taken the vehicle from the Wall Street residence without the permission of the owner. The 38-year-old was arrested for theft of a motor vehicle and taken to the Seneca County Jail. Sheriff Stevens says the immediate collaboration between their office and the Tiffin Police Department was instrumental in apprehending the suspect moments after the alleged arson. Get more in the story on our website. The debate continues over who controls the Republican Party's funds in Ohio.
Who controls the Ohio House Republican Alliance Fund? Is it the Speaker of the House? That would be Jason Stevens. Or is it the President of OHRA? That would be Representative Phil Plummer of Dayton. The inability to decide prompted a 3-judge panel hearing in the 10th District Court of Appeals. The judges ruled unanimously that the question is not for them to decide, but rather an internal matter for the party to decide, clarifying the vague language found in the Ohio Revised Code on the matter.
ONN's Tracy Townsend reporting. The Finley Family YMCA held a groundbreaking ceremony for its new early learning center, with some of the youngest Child Development Center students turning the first ceremonial shovelfuls of dirt. YMCA CEO Stephanie Parsons says the early learning center will serve as the ultimate launching pad for the children who will benefit from its many services.
We know that child care is a major need in Hancock County. This project will address that community need.
The new Early Learning Center is expected to open by early fall 2025. See designs for it in this story on our website. Remember, you can always get more news online anytime at WFIN.com.
our cover story this morning. University of Findlay President Dr. Catherine Fell is with us. We have an update on the merger between UF and Bluffton University, which obviously we know has been in the works for quite some time. And Dr. Fell, thanks very much for taking the time. I know busy time for you. So,
Chris, thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here this morning.
So I want to get to the merger here in just a bit. But as we mentioned, very exciting time. I mean, obviously, just a few weeks ago, welcoming in a new class of students for a new academic year. That's always got to be a really special time to see all of these new students ready to start their academic journey at the university.
Of course it is.
Arch ceremony and all of that.
Yeah. The art ceremony is a wonderful tradition when we welcome them and when we send them out.
Yeah.
But we did welcome students this fall from 31 states. Happy to report that. 71 of Ohio's 88 counties.
Wow.
44 students were in the top 5% of their high school graduating classes. 161 of those students report that they are first-generation students. We're very proud of that. We believe we take really good care of those students.
Yeah.
The average GPA for our incoming class is 3.67, and we'll have 184 first-year student-athletes on our mini athletic teams. They're already working hard, and they seem pretty excited, a little bit sore.
Yeah, I'm sure. That's an interesting statistic, the number of first-time, first-generation college students.
I agree. I think they are attracted to a place like the University of Findlay. We give much attention to our students. I think we're well known for that, and we're not the only university well known for that, but yeah. I think the University of Findlay puts its special brand upon that, and our culture is welcoming. It's faith-based and welcoming to all. Our students feel that they can find a place there, whatever they are seeking as their purpose in life.
Right.
So I'm very pleased that they chose us.
Yeah. And then here in just a couple of weeks will be, it's kind of the mirror image or the flip side of those new students who are just starting out, homecoming weekend, welcoming back in all of those individuals who have taken that experience at the University of Findlay out into the world.
Our alumni make us very proud. They do indeed, and we love it when they come back. They come back with excitement. They bring their children. In fact, one of the vice chairs of our board is bringing his daughters to campus for an official campus visit, and I can assure you they will get a great deal of attention. But I would like to say that we give a great deal of attention to all of our visiting students.
Yeah, I would imagine that there are probably a few of those official, unofficial visits.
Yes, we actually have visits almost every day.
Yeah.
But I would imagine families and students.
Alumni bringing their
alumni
back and
families, yes.
Making the case, making the pitch.
Yes. Once again. And you know, our alumni tend to have had a great experience and speak well of us, so they sell it for us.
Yeah. I'm guessing that some of the questions that you'll probably hear from a number of those alumni regard that merger, the pending merger between the University of Findlay and Bluffton University. It was announced some months ago. Where does that stand right now? I know the process has already begun.
It has begun. We announced that in March this past spring. Mm-hmm. We are well on our way. We've formed 16 transition teams made up of representatives from both campuses to work in virtually every area of campus to find synergies and to plan the details of our application. There are many applications to make. The first one is to our accreditors, the Higher Learning Commission, and then the Ohio Department of Higher Education. From there, once we're approved at those two levels, we'll move on to the federal level. But a great deal of merging work occurs even now as we plan. We have synergies in academic programs, academic services, career services. We are trying to work together and become very helpful to one another, even as we wait for the application. Upon that first level of application and approval, then in many respects, we become one university, though it's not official an official merger until the federal government is done. But we take on responsibility. The University of Findlay takes on a great deal of responsibility with Bluffton upon that first stage of approval. And we are gearing up for that. We're excited about it. I believe it will go well.
It's interesting. You mentioned 16 different teams.
Yes.
This is quite the process, quite an elaborate process.
Day and night, we are working on this.
Is this more elaborate, more involved, maybe than you even realized when you first started this journey?
That would be a safe statement. That would be a very safe statement.
Yeah.
We've talked to other campus leaders who are in the process. The level of detail that we must attend is quite significant, but we are learning a great deal about what this could mean for Northwest Ohio, not just our two institutions, but as I've said before, maybe the last time we spoke, Chris, about this, there will be many other mergers coming in higher education throughout the country.
Yeah. It's interesting that you mention the possibilities. We talk about the fact that maybe there are even more details than what you anticipated going in that have come up. I would imagine that there are also more opportunities that you have realized as you have looked deeper and gotten further into the process.
Absolutely. So we even now, we may have seats in one of our classes, let's say, an English class or a Spanish class or a health professions class that students from Bluffton would be welcome to fill, and vice versa. We might fill some of their seats. So already there are ways we're helping one another and helping our students move through their curricula more quickly because we can make space. We have a broader array of offerings for them at our university and at Bluffton University. We're also learning a great deal about each other's culture. I would say one of the most significant of our transition teams is the faith and culture team. It's been working hard, worked through the summer, is working now in the fall. We want to secure what is deep and important to each campus. Each of us was founded in a Christian faith, the Mennonite denomination at Bluffton, and of course the Churches of God denomination on our campus. We want to honor those traditions without losing identity on either campus. The same is true on the athletic front. It's a very important part of our cultures. Division III sports will remain at Bluffton University, NCAA, and God willing. And so far, NCAA seems positively inclined to this idea.
So that is good news as well. We mentioned the 16 transition teams. This is really, for the most part, happening, I don't want to say behind the scenes, but internally mostly.
It is.
I mean, the students are not necessarily outside of, again, as you mentioned, some shared classes. But other than that, this is all really happening behind the scenes.
It is,
the sausage,
Chris.
Is being
the faculty and staff are doing this work. The students are unaffected, except that they know about it, and they're excited about it. Our students and the Bluffton students are eager to get together. We hope to get them together for a number of social events, but they would also like to play some intramural sports, and I think that might be a great fun to watch.
Yeah. So what is the timeline? I mean, is that still on track for what you expect?
Well, it'll take longer than we originally thought to actually get the final federal government approval. But as I said, probably within a year and a half, we will be working together far more closely as if we are merged. But we still have a number of applications and approvals even beyond that. But we are able to work very closely together after this first set of approvals, which should happen, I would say, that first set of approvals should come in by December or January of next year.
Yeah.
Not this year, but next year.
Next year. So it is a process we will continue to follow, continue to watch. And again, Dr. Catherine Fell, University of Findlay president, with us this morning with an update. Thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate
Thank you.
A big night in politics tonight, of course. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump set for their high-stakes debate, what will almost certainly be their only one-on-one face-off before the November election, and it has taken on heightened importance given the new Siena College New York Times poll showing the race is a dead heat. It is tonight in Philadelphia, and obviously Pennsylvania is a state that could determine who wins the presidency. ABC News is the host, every network carrying it, starting at 9 p.m. Eastern tonight. So that is the big story that everybody is talking about. But meanwhile, at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, Congress is back in session after their summer recess. And on the agenda this week, a series of measures targeting emerging threats from China. Representative Bob Latta is with us on the line this morning. And I understand among the measures that are due for a vote this week is one of yours, the Routers Act, correct?
Right. Yeah, thanks very much for having me on this morning. And we are focusing on Communist China and the influences that they're having on this country. And in fact, I handled three pieces of legislation dealing with China last night on the floor as the one of the senior members on the Energy and Commerce Committee. My bill, the Routers Act, was up. And if you think about this, you know, we know that Communist China is always spying on us. They're stealing as much as they possibly can from us, especially our intellectual property. But if you, people think about it, go look and see where your router is made for your in your house. Mm-hmm. And so many of these are made in Communist China. And so what my legislation says is this. We need to have a study done to see if any of this can be picked up, transmitted back to Communist China. Because any company that is Chinese-based, under their law, they have to turn over all information to the Communist Chinese Party. So that was one of the pieces of legislation that was on the floor last night. Drones is another issue, is a great concern, because you think with all the communist drones flying around our country, you know, people got very upset when there was a balloon flying over the country.
Right.
But just think about all the thousands and thousands of drones that are flying all over the country. So, you know, we want to protect Americans. And we all know what happened. It came through our committee with TikTok. That TikTok, when, again, I think you and I have talked about in the past, mm-hmm. when the CEO was going to be coming before us, he asked if he could meet with me. And I asked him a simple question. I said, can any of the information that you get be transmitted back to Communist China? He wouldn't answer my question. And so it turned out I asked him the question in committee, and it turned out, yeah, that information can. So Communist China is not a trading partner. They are considered an adversary of this country, and we have to treat them as such.
I know that, you know, obviously these threats are very real, and these measures, you're dubbing it China Week in Congress with all of these measures being taken up, really focusing on these emerging threats. And obviously this is a very important issue. However, you also have a looming deadline to hammer out a deal on government funding measures, facing the possibility of at least a limited government shutdown if nothing is resolved there in a very short amount of time. And as a matter of fact, ahead of the summer recess, that was one of the big narratives, is that there wasn't going to be a whole lot of time left to hammer out those agreements. Can you do all of this and still get that done? I mean, some would say that should be an even higher priority.
Well, in fact, I serve on the whip and the deputy whip teams, and we were whipping that bill last night. It also included in the bill is what we call the SAVE Act. And what we're saying in that piece of legislation is that only American citizens should be voting in federal elections. We know that a lot of these liberal cities around the country, Washington, D.C. being one, will let non-citizens vote in municipal elections. But what's going to stop people from them voting in a federal election? And so that's. But we want to have that piece of legislation on the floor tomorrow. Because this will take us through March the 28th of next year for spending measures, but we want to get this thing done. So we'll have that most likely on the floor by late tomorrow afternoon.
Yeah, Democrats have criticized trying to attach that piece to the budget measures. They point out that this is a solution in search of a problem. It is already illegal for people who are non-citizens to vote in federal elections. Why do we need another measure attached to the funding bill in order to reiterate that, if not just for partisan political purposes?
Well, what this will do is you have to prove your citizenship before you can vote, which I think is important, because right now you just check a box. That's what's happening. People check a box. If they, you know, they send them down to Bureau of Motor Vehicles in states, and they hand them a form, and they check a box, you know, yeah, I want to vote. And in some places, they send them a ballot. But we want to make sure that, especially because people, you know, as I went across this work period that we have in August, I covered my district, north, south, east, west. You know, one of the concerns I heard out there from people was they're fearful that about having fair elections. And we want to make sure that the American people know that only U.S. citizens are voting in our elections.
Is there any evidence, though, that this is a widespread problem, or is this more about reassuring people that the problem doesn't exist?
Well, I think it's a couple of things. Number one, you know, when you have almost a state of the population, over 11 million people cross the border illegally into this country under this administration, you know, again, people don't know. First of all, you know, we got over 100,000 kids out there that unaccompanied minors. We have no idea where they're at. We don't know where these people went. You know, when you cross the border, you're usually given a to turn back up into a hearing in 3, 4, 5 years. You talk to the Border Patrol, they say these people are never going to show back up. But, you know, again, it's making sure, because we've never had a situation like this where we've had such a massive number of people illegally crossing our border, especially with an administration that did absolutely nothing to stop it.
That actually segues into something I did want to ask you about here real quickly. I'm sure that immigration will come up during tonight's presidential debate. I'm guessing you will be watching. As we mentioned, the stakes are very high. This latest poll showing that it is a dead heat. What are you going to be watching for tonight between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump?
Well, I think that most people know where President Trump stands on the issues, but I think it's really important because we've seen the vice president flip-flopping about on everything. You know, when we all just remember, she was, quote-unquote, the border czar, and I don't think she got any closer to the border than being in an airport hangar. And then so I know I wasn't. She said, I'm not doing that. And then she's flip-flopping a lot of other issues out there. But, you know, I think the issues that are really important that the American people have to remember are this vice president broke more ties because, you know, we have such, you know, in the Senate, it was such a close margin the Democrats control by just a hair over there. And so she was sitting in that chair breaking ties, and she brought on a lot of this massive government spending that brought on the massive inflation that Americans are still dealing with. And, you know, when you think about these job numbers that keep being revised, they kept touting these wonderful job numbers across the country. And what we're seeing is that they keep being revised. They say, oh, no, they made a mistake. There weren't that many jobs created. So I think the American people have to know where she stands, especially on those issues, where she stands on taxing the American people. You know, what we have in this country, we don't have a revenue issue. We have a spending problem. And again, when you see what they did in the first 2 years of this administration, they controlled the House, the Senate, and the presidency. They brought all this on to the American people.
We will leave it there for now. Obviously going to be watching very closely tonight a very consequential debate between the presidential candidates, not just for the presidential election, but also for all of those down ballot races as well. Again, Congressman Bob Latta, thanks very much for taking the time this morning. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, and have a wonderful day.
Well, today is the day. It is another excursion to our nation's capital. Flag City Honor Flight, the third of four charters this year, to take another group of veterans to Washington, D.C. And joining us this morning with a live update ahead of takeoff from Toledo Express is Honor Flight Media Director Will Miller. Will, thanks for taking some time here this morning. Lots of things going on pre-flight, as always, for all of the veterans and their and the folks who will accompany them on this flight.
Well, good morning, Chris. How are you this morning? We have a great flight planned here for this morning for us, and we have about 85 veterans that are going to be on this flight, and we're going to get ready to take off in about 15, 20 minutes here and get them all over to Washington, D.C. to see those memorials that was built in their honor. So got a couple, got three Korean War veterans and quite a few Vietnam veterans on this flight, Chris.
So that was going to be my question, kind of the breakdown. Obviously, as folks know, Flag City Honor Flight originally was dedicated to taking World War II veterans to see the World War II memorial. But obviously, over the years, this has expanded and grown as, you know, taking all of our heroes to see the, as you said, the main attraction is the memorials that were built in their honor. I know you also visit Arlington National Cemetery, and it is a full day for these vets.
Yes, yeah, you're absolutely correct, Chris. We did start by taking the World War II veterans. You know, and as time has moved on and a lot of those veterans passed, and we've taken as many of those as we can take, we've moved into the Korean War and now mainly into the Vietnam veterans. And yeah, we get there to Washington and they get a chance to see that memorials, get over to the cemetery to see that changing of the guard ceremony. And you know, just some of the things like that, where just want to give back and show some honor and respect to all these veterans for all the things they did for us over the years.
And just to emphasize, this is all, this is a one-day trip. I mean, you'll fly there, you'll do all of those things, you'll fly home. It's a long day, but it is a single day, big, big a day full of just a full schedule for veterans. This is a packed day.
Yeah, you're right, Chris. You know, we're going to take off here shortly. We're going to get into Baltimore, you know, get down to those memorials, have some lunch, and, you know, go through the memorials, get over there to Arlington, check out the Air Force Memorial and everything like that, and then make our way back here to Toledo. Hopefully by around 8:30 this evening, we could probably be back down on the ground here in Toledo.
That is amazing. Also, you have with you one of the veterans who is on this flight from Findlay. And again, the veterans for Flag City Honor Flight come from Findlay and all over Northwest Ohio. But Larry Holman is with us as well on the line. And Larry, how have you been to D.C. before? Have you seen these memorials at all?
No, I haven't.
So this is the first time, and that's a story that is pretty familiar. Most, if not all, of the veterans will be visiting for the first time. What is, first of all, what conflict did you serve during, Larry?
War.
I'm sorry?
Vietnam War.
Oh, you were at Vietnam. So is that what you're looking most forward to, is seeing the Vietnam Veterans Memorial?
Yes, definitely.
Talk a little bit about what this means as a veteran to be able to go to D.C., see these memorials, and know that this is honoring your service, your sacrifice.
Well, it's going to be really something to see all this. Kind of hard to believe that, you know, so many people lost their lives and a lot of people that I was with also. So it's going to be pretty touching.
I know that, especially with the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, it is a very sobering experience to see that memorial. And I'm sure that you've talked with other veterans who have had that experience and what it means to them.
Yeah, it's going to be quite an experience for me. I know that it's been a long time coming, I guess, but it's going to be, it's going to be pretty, in a way, pretty difficult, but it's going to be sobering, but it'll be great.
As we said, it's a big day. It's a busy day. Starts very early and will go well into the evening. how excited are you for this full day to see not just the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, but all of the other monuments and, as we mentioned, going to Arlington, seeing the changing of the guard? It's really the full experience.
Yeah, it's going to be a long day, but I think it's going to be really a lot of fun and going to be a lot of memories and things like that.
How long were you on the waiting list? How long ago was it that you signed up for this flight?
It wasn't very long. It was only about 3 months.
But I would imagine the anticipation, and especially when you get that call saying you've got a seat on this flight, I would imagine that's in and of itself just kind of a full rush of emotions.
Oh, yeah, it definitely is, man. I've been waiting for this a long time, and now that it's happened, I'm really ready for it.
Again, Larry Holman is a local veteran, Vietnam veteran from Findlay, will be on the honor flight, which will be taking off here shortly from Toledo Express Airport. And certainly, Larry, thank you very much for your service, and we appreciate your time. Let me speak with Will again here real quickly. A big thank you to everyone who helps make this happen. As we have said before, Flag City Honor Flight, an all-volunteer organization, but then the number of volunteers that have to also come together to make these flights happen, because everyone has a chaperone, for lack of a better term. All of the veterans do. So this involves an awful lot of planning and coordination with a lot of people, both here and in Washington, D.C.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, Chris. You know, we have, you know, the 85 veterans, they all have a guardian that goes along with them to kind of help them all day and be there with them for anything they may need. Mm-hmm. We also have a lot of other support staff, some folks doing the wheelchairs, obviously some photographers, and a bunch of other support staff that goes out here to be able to make this whole flight happen and get us all to Washington, D.C., get us back safely, and sponsorship. And that's so important, too, Chris, because, you know, this flight wouldn't be possible without the marathon folks down there, because, you know, the folks down the marathon, they sponsored this entire flight, which is getting us to Washington, D.C. today, which is a huge thing. But, you know, that's just like one of the great local businesses that actually come out and support Flag City Honor Flight and our mission for many years. And they've been with us since the very beginning, Chris, and they've been an early supporter, and they believed in Flag City Honor Flight and what we do, getting these veterans to Washington, D.C. And we couldn't thank them enough for being the supporters they are, and be able to help us in anything that we've ever needed.
Absolutely, and certainly credit, all credit where credit is due. And when the flight returns, I know this is one of the coolest things. Veterans on the honor flight, when you return to Toledo Express this evening, they come back to a hero's welcome, and everybody is welcome to join you for the return and the celebration of those veterans.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Chris. 7 o'clock, the doors up here at the Grand Air Hangar open. Grand Air is right here at Toledo Express Airport. It's at the end of the runway up here, so it's on West Service Road up here in right next to the airport. So if you would like to come up and kind of greet these heroes as they come home from this honor flight. We open up at 7 o'clock, come in. Flight, we try to be home hopefully around 8:30 or so. And we would love to have as many of you come out to greet these heroes when they come home and give them that well-deserved welcome home that they never received, 50 years ago, 60 years ago, 70 years ago.
Yeah.
They never received. So we want to get them that proper welcome home and thank them for their service.
Absolutely. It is very much deserved and long overdue. And certainly we wish you and all of the veterans and their guardians and everybody involved safe travels, Godspeed, and good luck. And again, Flag City Honor Flight Media Director Will Miller with us this morning. We'll let you go because I know you got to get on board and head off to Washington, D.C., but we appreciate you taking a few minutes of your time for us this morning ahead of departure. Thanks very much.
Well, Chris, we appreciate it.
We do have a link up for more information about Flag City Honor Flight, their mission. One more flight yet to come this year. This is the third of four this year. A very busy schedule for the Honor Flight folks. You can go to goodmornings.net to learn more.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
We interrupt this program to bring you a broken news alert.
A light day, actually, in the broken news today, but we do have a few items. This from the International File, the broken news. An appliance shop in China could lose up to the equivalent of $4.2 million due to incorrect pricing on their website. The Little Swan Dongshan Franchise Shop. Where do they come up with these names? The Little Swan Dongshan Franchise Shop. Apparently advertised a washing machine on their website at a ridiculously low price. The washing machine that sold for about $240 was listed for just $42. And they sold over 40,000 units in just 20 minutes. This happened about a week and a half ago. They discovered the error and took the listing down, but not before 40,000 units were ordered at $42 a piece. The company is attempting to issue refunds instead of honoring the sales. In a statement, the company says, quote, "We humbly beg you to understand our difficulties and to agree to withdraw orders." Try and send everybody their $42 back instead of sending them their washing machine. I understand that in this country we're worried about Chinese products and being dumped in America and the economic threat from China. But then you see stories like these and you think, do we really get that much risk? I mean, they seem to have some issues in their pricing structure there. We have had, in the broken news over the years, a number of odd and unusual thefts, but this one is perhaps one of the most unusual I've ever seen. Baltimore police have arrested a 67-year-old by the name of Daniel Cairns. Mr. Cairns allegedly went on a spree stealing 4 speed cameras around the city. You know, those traffic cameras? They have those automatic cameras that track you speeding. Mr. Cairns stole 4 of the cameras. Why would you do that? Officials are continuing their investigation into other camera thefts in the area to see if this same gentleman is linked to those thefts as well. There have been a number of traffic cameras that have been disappearing. Mr. Cairns allegedly cut through the locks protecting the devices with a grinder saw. So far, they've arrested the guy, but none of the cameras have been found. We're still working to figure out what he did with them, according to Lieutenant Charles James, the Baltimore PD. The motive for stealing the cameras remains unclear. That's just weird. Of all the things that you can steal, you just wake up one day and say, I think I'm going to steal those traffic cameras. Let's see. Elsewhere in the broken news, a dime worth about $500,000 going to be going up for auction the end of October. It is owned by 3 sisters from Ohio. Doesn't say where in Ohio, but these 3 sisters inherited the unique coin, which was struck by the U.S. Mint in 1975. Here's what makes the dime so valuable. It does not have an S on it. Coins that are minted in San Francisco typically have an S to designate the mint at which they were struck. And this dime does not have the little tiny S on it next to the date Only two such dimes missing the S are known to exist. And the other sold in 2019 for $456,000. It's a dime! They're selling. I understand that it's rare, but $500,000. The dimes have been a mystery since the 1970s. Most major collectors and coin dealers have never seen one, said Ian Russell of Great Collections, which is doing the auction next month. This dime. It's amazing. I mean, dimes are tiny anyway, so this little tiny S is missing, and that's apparently enough to make it worth $500,000. But the three sisters from Ohio, they inherited it. They're going to sell it, presumably split the funds. Wow, that's quite the inheritance. I mean, you think when you inherit a dime from your loved one, that's not a big deal, but in this case, a very big deal. This is an interesting report. This is from the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. A new report finds that nearly 70% of American hospitals contain at least one fast food restaurant in their facility. The five most common fast food joints located in hospitals include Subway, Starbucks, Obon Pain. I'm not familiar with that one. I don't know what that is. Chick-fil-A and McDonald's. Dr. Zishan Ali, the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, says in a statement, making fast food like cheeseburgers and fried chicken available in hospitals is hazardous to the health of patients, visitors, and staff. They say too much fast food raises the risk of type 2 diabetes, heart disease, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so they say these fast food joints have no place in hospitals. But I'm thinking that this is a stroke of genius. Talk about drumming up new business. You know what I mean? It's a brilliant marketing strategy. But they're not happy. They want them out. Let's see. And finally, in the broken news, I said it's kind of a light day, but some interesting items here. The broken news. In New Hampshire, Governor Chris Sununu recently performed the Heimlich maneuver on a contestant at the Hampton Beach lobster roll eating competition. I'm not sure when this was. This like over Labor Day weekend, I would guess. Labor Day weekend. Yeah, the Hampton Beach lobster roll eating competition. One of the contestants began choking. The governor of the state of New Hampshire, Chris Sununu, stepped in and actually performed the Heimlich maneuver, after which the contestant went right back to eating. Hey, I'm not giving up. I got a contest to win here. Apparently, he ate another 7 lobster rolls after the governor performed the Heimlich maneuver. It was right down the gullet. The contestant, Christian Moreno, says it wasn't until after the competition that he learned it was the governor who saved his life. He says his counter, the person who, counts the number of lobster rolls he had eaten, my counter came up to me and said, you realize that it was the governor that gave you the Heimlich? I mean, who else can say that they have gotten the Heimlich maneuver from the governor before? Something that the governor is not usually called upon to, it's not a service that he's called upon to perform. Mr. Moreno says, I looked at the governor and I was just like, is that the governor? Despite the near-death experience, Moreno says he will be back next year seeking redemption. He did not win this year because, his eating was interrupted, but he'll be back next year seeking redemption. I don't know if the governor's going to be there next year, so you got to be careful. That's wild, though. The governor, of all people, lives stepping right up to perform the Heimlich. There you go. That is today's broken news report. The odd and unusual side of the headlines. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
The Findlay Trojans play here on WFIN. This is Tim Montgomery. Join me and Coach Cliff Height for all the action of Trojan football. You'll get every exciting play each Friday night, all season long, home and away.
This is Coach Stephen Adams. Up next on Friday night, the Trojans are at Oregon Clay.
Findlay Trojan football is here on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. We were talking about the debate tonight a little bit earlier. One of the issues likely to come up, almost certainly to come up, is the economy and inflation and its effect on average Americans. So with that in mind, I thought this was interesting. The financial platform Visual Capitalist mapped out how much $100 would be worth in each U.S. state based on regional price variations. Generally speaking, prices inflate when it comes to the coasts, both the East Coast and West Coast. And so that means the rest of us in Middle America generally get more bang for our buck. So by looking at median household incomes, cost of living expenses, and home values in each state, this is what they found. And there's a lot of data here, but it is really fascinating. In 18 states, the purchasing power of $100 is actually lower than $100. Those 18 states would be California, Hawaii, Washington, Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, New Hampshire, Oregon, Connecticut, Maryland, Rhode Island, Colorado, Florida, Virginia, Alaska, Illinois, Vermont, and Maine. The lowest value of $100 in terms of actual spending power is in California, where $100 is worth an estimated $88. So that's the lowest in the U.S. Conversely, in 12 states, the residents usually get around a 10% value add, with the real value of $100 ranging from $110 to $113. Those 12 states are Montana, Kansas, Nebraska, Kentucky, West Virginia, Oklahoma, North Dakota, Iowa, South Dakota, Alabama, Mississippi, and Arkansas. Ohio is just shy of that 10% benchmark, with $100 having the purchasing power in Ohio of $109. So if you adjust that for all of the regional variances, we actually get a little bit more bang for our buck in the Buckeye State than some other places, certainly more than the coasts, maybe not quite as much as some of these other states. The one state that maintains a perfect value where $100 is valued as $100 is the state of Arizona, of all places, which I thought was kind of interesting. And along the East Coast, we mentioned generally the coasts, the East Coast, the West Coast, where the value of $100 is the lowest. But there is one outlier. It is on the East Coast, and Delaware stands out with $100 worth $102 as compared to their more inflated neighbors. And not all that much less than Ohio, as it turns out. Well, did you know that more than 64 million Americans live with a disability? And for those individuals, a service dog can make all the difference in the world in their ability to sort of interface and interact with the rest of the world around them. But many do not have service dogs to help them lead those independent lives. And this morning, we are joined by Paige Mazzoni. She is CEO of Canine Companions, along with Raquel White, Vice President of Corporate Affairs at Yukonuba, who have teamed with Canine Companions for a National Service Dog Awareness Month campaign. Thank you both for being with us this morning. First of all, and Paige, I want to start with you, actually. I think we've all seen a service dog, someone with a service dog working, but absent that firsthand experience, it's difficult to understand just how important they are. So explain, help us understand more about the role of service dogs.
Sure. So as you said, over 64 million Americans have a disability that could be helped by the support of a service dog. At Canine Companions, we train service dogs to help people with over 65 different disabilities, ranging from physical disabilities to cognitive disabilities to hearing loss to military-related PTSD. And we place our dogs with children, adults, and veterans free of charge. We also have facility dogs who work in locations with professionals such as the criminal justice system, health services facilities, and education. And all of those dogs help many, many people every day with their handler in those settings. And we also have a 98% success rate at matching our dogs with their partner, which we're very, very proud of.
So there is a difference between a service dog and a support animal, frequently called emotional support animals. Explain the difference.
Service dogs are task trained. So they are trained with specific tasks, such as opening doors, retrieving items, pulling a wheelchair, that help mitigate the symptoms of a disability. An emotional support animal or even a therapy dog are dogs who really are there to provide comfort, but they're not task trained and they're not trained to be working dogs like a service dog is.
So as we mentioned, it's easy to see where a service dog would be in some cases critical to, again, these individuals being able to lead independent lives, and yet many don't have them. I've often been told that cost is the biggest barrier. As you said, you provide these free of charge. Is historically that been the barrier? Is that why you do this free of charge?
Cost has been one of the barriers for people, and people either have to pay for the service dog or have to pay to have the service dog accredited or certified as a follow-up throughout the life. We do all of that for free. But the other mitigating factor is that these dogs take 2 years to train. They're highly, highly specialized animals. And that is also expensive to do. And so there are not enough of them out there for the number of people who could benefit from having a service dog. So that's where we're really trying to grow our program to be able to serve more people.
So that leads us to the question, what exactly do you, as you mentioned, you perform, or you train dogs to perform any number of tasks, such as what? What are some examples?
Right. So we invented the concept of the modern service dog. And since our beginning in 1975, we have evolved our methods through our professional trainers on our 7 campuses to train over 45 tasks. And those tasks include things like helping someone pull on their socks or take off their sweater, helping them retrieve items, taking a person who is hearing impaired to a sound and alerting them that a sound has gone off, and then taking them to that sound. So think about a doorbell going off. They also can turn on and off lights. They can do a wide variety of tasks that help the person live more independently.
That is amazing. Some of those things I didn't even realize that service dogs would be able to do. Again, we see these, you know, in public, and we see some of what they do, but, you know, it's just amazing all of the things that they are capable of doing when they're properly trained and when you have enough of them, which, Raquel, I want to bring you into the conversation here. As we mentioned, in honor of National Service Dog Awareness Month, Yukonuba and Canine Companions have this special campaign running. Tell us about this.
Yeah, you know, for more than 30 years, Yukonuba Dog Food has partnered with Canine Companions to provide the science-based nutrition formulated for the needs of service dogs and working dogs. And so it's really important for us to support Canine Companions in their mission of matching more dogs with people with disabilities. So this year, we have a new campaign called Feed Yukonuba, Fuel Independence. And it's from now through the end of the year, you can buy a 28-pound bag or larger of Yukonuba dog food, and $20 will go to Canine Companions to help with their fundraising, which is so important because, as you heard Paige say, they give their dogs absolutely free of charge to the people with disabilities that they serve.
Yeah. So as people are taking care of their dogs, you can help service dogs take care of their people in this case.
That's right.
As you mentioned, this is not just running through the month, but through the end of the year, correct?
Correct. That's right. Yes, December 31st.
Okay, so, and if I don't have a dog, first of all, I can't imagine a family without a dog, but there are some. If I don't have a dog, but I still want to help, how do I do that?
So first of all, Canine Companions is a 501c3 charity, so you can do charitable donations. Any amount is welcomed and very helpful. You can also volunteer to fundraise. You can volunteer to be a puppy raiser for the first 18 months of the puppy's lives and get them some of the initial training before they go to school. So there are a number of opportunities that you can help and contribute, but you can certainly learn more at ukanuba.com/US/canine-companions.
Very good. And we will have that linked up at our webpage. I would also suggest that if you don't have a dog yourself, but you care about animals, you can buy a bag of Ukanuba dog food and donate it to a shelter. And therefore, you can help shelter animals and you can help service animals all at the same time. So there would be another.
I love that.
There you go. Again, Raquel White from Ukanuba and Paige Mazzoni from the Canine Companions with us this morning, talking about National Service Dog Awareness Month and this campaign. Raquel, mention again the website where folks can learn more.
Absolutely. ukanuba.com/US/canine-companions.
Ladies, thank you both for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program, of course. Once again, remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the show at our webpage, that is goodmornings.net. Coming up tomorrow on the program, this year marks the 45th anniversary of the beginning of the Iranian hostage crisis. 7 months after 50 Americans were taken hostage at the American embassy in Iran, a similar hostage crisis took place in London at the hands of Iraq's Saddam Hussein. In his new book, The Siege, best-selling author Ben McIntyre details that crisis and how it laid the groundwork to such moments as 9/11, the Iraq War, and the current events in Gaza. So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.